From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama makes his move on guns, explosive intervention, and hostage-taking in North Africa. Lance Armstrong says, yes, he doped. On a White House dais with children, reminders of the Newtown massacre, the president made his pitch on guns.
If there is even one thing we can do to reduce this violence, if there's even one life that can be saved, then we've got an obligation to try.
Scores of hostages, maybe scores dead, no one knows, at an oil plant in Algeria. A rough grab and rough rescue. Here's ABC News, Martha Raddatz.
Reports we are getting tonight about the raid are very ominous. A U.S. official telling me tonight there were 10 Americans at the field. Five are safe, but the fate of the other five, we do not know.
And after years of fierce denials of doping, renowned cyclist and cancer survivor Lance Armstrong confessed otherwise in an interview with Oprah Winfrey.
Yes or no?
Okay.
Okay. Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with CNN's Jake Tapper, NBC News' Kelly O'Donnell, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Where are we headed on guns, on hostages, on Inauguration Day? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Jake Tapper, now CNN anchorman and chief Washington correspondent, author of The Outpost, Wise Eye on the White House and Beyond. Jake, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Washington, Kelly O'Donnell, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent. Kelly, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jake, and Kelly.
I want to just, here's a little sound from Algeria. Algerian national television yesterday, what a mess over there. Here was the communications minister saying that the rescue operation was successful, but there were deaths. He couldn't say how many. Here he is interpreted by Al Jazeera English.
The operation was successful in neutralizing a large number of terrorists and freeing a large number of hostages. But unfortunately, and we're sorry to say this, there were some deaths and injuries. We do not yet have a definitive figure.
And here was Hillary Clinton saying, we don't know much.
Because of the fluidity and the fact that there is a lot of planning going on, I cannot give you any further details at this time.
Jake, this has been such a wild story. The French go into Mali, and the next thing you know, we've got these images of a bus being pulled over or something, and some kind of big attack on this plant way out in the middle of nowhere, Algeria on the Libyan border. Do you have any sense of what the bottom line may be here, Jake, or is it still just a mystery?
Well, it's a mystery in terms of the specifics, and the last person I spoke with, somebody who is a knowledgeable source, said that the Americans still don't know how many of the hostages, of the 40-odd hostages that were taken, how many of them were killed in this raid by the Algerian authorities. that Algeria probably was a little bit more aggressive in their raid, given the circumstances, than the U.S. would have been, given all the innocents who were taken there. But I think in a larger way, this now brings attention to an issue that counterterrorism officials have been warning about for a long time, which is al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which is the African affiliate of al-Qaeda. The U.S. has been more focused on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. That's the al-Qaeda in Yemen and Abdul Muttalib, the Christmas Day bomber, would-be Christmas Day bomber. But now we have a new focus on the terrorists of northern Africa. Northern Mali is obviously one of the most dangerous places there is right now. And, of course, Libya and Algeria are part of that as well.
New focus, but it also looks like new vulnerability. I mean, so far you had some American officials talking big, but that was about all. As far as we can see, this morning in London, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta saying the United States will not tolerate terrorism in North Africa or the hostage situation in Algeria.
Terrorists should be on notice that they will find no sanctuary, no refuge, not in Algeria, not in North Africa, not anywhere.
Kelly O'Donnell on Capitol Hill, this is a big piece of terrain we're talking about here. You put together Algeria, Mali, enormous, Libya unsettled still, Europe looking down here very nervously, and there's the defense secretary talking big. But at this point, does it feel like anybody's got a handle on the range of what's going on here, Kelly?
Well, I think there has been this sense that Jake alluded to, that there are U.S. officials who have seen the threat looming, that there would be such high risk in the northern part of Africa, a place where most Americans are not that familiar with what's been happening. Our attention sort of collectively has been focused in the other hot spots. And there has been a lot of discussion on Capitol Hill in classified and private settings about these threats. I think one of the great challenges for the government is just how many hotspots there are to try to deal with at the same time. Here you have Leon Panetta, who is, you know, at the end of his tenure at the Pentagon, trying to come up with ways to show that strength, to demonstrate that the U.S. is paying attention. Apparently, the U.S. has sent a drone to try to be able to observe. But in a situation like this, while there is still the fluidity they talk about, there's very little they can tell us publicly without the further risk of endangering hostages that may be alive, the uncertainty of what's happening here. And while we want our partners around the world to be aggressive, in Libya, there was so much concern about the Libyans not coming to the aid of Americans in the Benghazi attack. Here, the Algerians did move, but they moved in a way that might not be in step with how the U.S. would have done it.
Jack Beatty, here we are in the drone era, where we have the sense that we can see everything all the time, and boom, here comes the boondocks of Algeria disproving that pretty mightily. I mean, from what I could see, there was a drone on the way there, but way behind the action, and the U.S. not on top of it. I think Jake Tapper may be very diplomatic when he says the Algerian military was a little more aggressive than the U.S. military might have been. I mean, it appears we do not know, but there are suggestions of potentially scores of innocents dead here.
Yes, and the latest I see now at just before 10 o'clock from Reuters, 60 foreign hostages still there, still held, an attack still in, of some sort still going on. You know, what strikes me about all this, just backing up to the Malian context, over the last years we have spent, I think the figure I saw in the Times was $500 million training the Malian army, getting it ready. What happened? They had when the insurgents started to attack them, the crucial units broke, officers defected to the other side. Meanwhile, back in the Malian capital, officers trained by the United States engineered a coup against the government there.
Last year,
now, now, all of this is about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. But since when does America have vital interests in Timbuktu? I mean, the whole question of what danger do rebels in, you know, insurgents in Mali posed to the United States, that's something that apparently wasn't either debated enough or just assumed that we have an interest in it. And I think Congress has got to look into that. Why did we spend all this money? Why were we so wrong in the people we bet on? And how can we do better?
Well, I mean, you'd like to know why all that money wasn't more effective. And I want to be fair to the Algerians. At this point, the Algerian State News Service is saying that 100 out of 132 foreign hostages have been freed from the gas plant. That's an accomplishment. But we still don't know what the final death toll on both sides there's going to be. But, I mean, on the other hand, Jack, isn't this kind of Exhibit A? Let me put it to you, Jake Tapper. Here's a very big energy plant with Americans and others, British, Norwegian, Americans working there, oil flowing to Europe and well beyond, I'm sure. Is this kind of Exhibit A of what the threat might be, Jake?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely, that seems like a sitting duck of a target. Especially, you know, with what has been going on in Mali in the last week, and then the French taking their military action when the red line in their view was crossed by these Islamic extremists, and then the U.S. of course now involved, having agreed to help transport French soldiers to Mali, providing what's called ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, basically drone aircraft. To help spy. And other requests have come in from the French. I think they want the U.S. to provide refueling for their aircraft. The U.S. has not yet, the Obama administration has not yet agreed to that. But this is how the U.S. gets in, this is how classically Western nations get tied down and bogged down in wars. This is absolutely what's going on right now.
But you've got the French president. Here's a little tape of Hollande saying, look, this hostage situation in Algeria proves why the French, anyway, need to be in Mali. Here he is.
Ce qui se passe en Algérie.
What is happening in Algeria justifies even more the decision I took in the name of France to come and help Mali, in compliance with a charter of the United Nations and at the request of the president of the country.
Here's the reason. Here's why we're there, Kelly. Do you see the U.S. sort of flagrantly, you know, rolling around money in the Maghreb in North Africa? Or does the U.S. have a choice when you've got this kind of unraveling possibility right across the Mediterranean from Europe?
Well, we've seen how in the Arab Spring, things can quickly move out of anyone's predictions and ability to try to contain. And that's been a real concern. And when you have U.S. interests, and especially when you're talking about energy interests at this kind of a plant around the world, there will be these sorts of settings where Americans will be at work, where U.S. interests will be at work in places that are very inhospitable to the West. This is a concern. I have been hearing from lawmakers who have been reading some of the classified reports and have tried in the ways that they can talk about it publicly to signal this is a real concern and that the instability that we have seen in places like Libya is a warning shot for the whole region. This is the kind of example where just days ago, no one knew this would be a hot spot. Now it is capturing our attention.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Guns, hostages, Lance Armstrong. Looking ahead to Inauguration Day on Monday with Jake Tapper, chief Washington correspondent and anchor for CNN. With Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC, and Jack Beatty is here. There was a long drum roll after Newtown of the country waiting to see what Joe Biden and the president would roll out. On Wednesday, there he was with kids on the dais and a lot to say about guns. Here, guns and the Second Amendment. Here's the president.
I also believe most gun owners agree that we can respect the Second Amendment while keeping an irresponsible, law-breaking few from inflicting harm on a massive scale. I believe most of them agree that if America worked harder to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, there would be fewer atrocities like the one that occurred in Newtown.
There were people ready to argue that right away. The NRA at the head of the line. Here was the NRA president, David Keene, criticizing the president's push on gun control, saying you won't control gun violence by controlling guns. This is on CBS on Wednesday.
Anybody who dies from any reason at the hands of a criminal or somebody who's insane, or in an accident for that matter, is a tragedy. Nobody's saying it isn't. But what I am saying is that banning these firearms is not going to accomplish very much.
NRA's President David Keene. Jake Tapper, here was the president saying, you know, I'm going to put everything I've got into gun control. In his first term, that certainly didn't happen. Here's Newtown right before the holidays, and the whole country just shocked by it. What does he mean when he says he's going to put everything he's got into it? Do you really see this at somewhere near the top of his agenda? What do you see coming here, Jake?
Certainly, and in fact, his campaign apparatus is becoming a new kind of organization. I think it's a 501c4, like the American Crossroads, the Karl Rove-inspired group, that will now be in charge of trying to motivate the public, and not just getting New York City and Los Angeles and San Francisco residents calling members of Congress and urging them to support greater restrictions on firearms, but also people in Virginia, North Carolina, and Indiana. And that is the plan to try to more directly go at this measure and go restrict the kinds of firearms and high capacity magazines that are available to people.
How do you interpret that, Jake? Is that because the president was moved by what he saw in Newtown, and after 4 years where he didn't say much about guns, this single event has really got him on a policy push here? Was it something emotional? You know, he's got kids too. Was it he sees a way here to get a new coalition of voters together around an issue the Republicans are on the other side of largely? How do you read the politics?
Well, I think, first of all, my understanding from sources close to the president is, yes, this event did impact him in a very powerful and profound way. To the point of you know, having some real emotional moments on his own in the days following the Sandy Hook massacre. So I do think that that's part of it. Obviously, the fact that he is now never, ever going to run for anything ever again, frees him up and frees his hand a little bit. There, you know, as you point out, he hasn't done anything having to do with restrictions on guns in his first term other than lifting them, signing laws that include provisions to allow firearms on trains and in national parks. So I think this is an area where a lot of Democrats have argued since 2000, especially when Al Gore's loss was blamed in part on his position in favor of gun control and losing states like Tennessee and West Virginia. That was blamed on his position on gun control. For Gore, a lot of Democrats have taken at face value that any advocacy for greater restrictions on firearms is an electoral loser. That certainly was the position of the Obama White House in the first term. And in fact, at one point, the Attorney General was talking about trying to, I believe it was trying to reinstate what's called the assault weapons ban. It's a ban on several kinds of semi-automatic rifles that expired in 2004. And he received a message from the then White House Chief of Staff. This is according to a book by Dan Kleidman about the Obama presidency, in which Rahm Emanuel told passed on a message that he should shut the F up on guns. So this isn't only an area where he hasn't done anything. It's an area where he has aggressively told others in his administration, or the White House has told others in his administration, not to do something. And I think there's regret there. And I think, you know, I asked a question of the president in my last time asking him a question that some people didn't particularly care for, where I asked him, you know, this is not the first, he had been saying for about a week, you know, this is the fourth major massacre on my watch. And I asked him, you know, this has been going on for a while, as you point out, where have you been?
Yeah.
A lot of people didn't like the tone, but I think one of the reasons he bristled, this is just my own, dime store psychology, is one of the reasons he bristled and got defensive is because I think personally, and based on talking to people around him, I think he regrets it.
That sounded very much like Rahm Emanuel advice there. Kelly?
I censored it for you.
Yes, audience, thank so you. Thank you very
he
much.
He didn't use the word. He did not actually say the letter F.
Yes, no doubt. I mean, here's a big issue. You've got the constitutional issues, a cultural divide, you know, arm up or arm down in response to this. The way Capitol Hill responds will be not everything we see, but it will be a lot. Here was a little tape of Republican Colorado Congressman Cory Gardner talking with CNN's Dana Bash, saying the GOP wants to talk about mental health, not gun control.
I hope that we can work with the president on issues that concern mental health. I hope.
But what about gun control?
I don't think gun control is the right direction, and I believe most of my colleagues in the House Republican Conference would disagree with gun control measures.
Kelly, what do you see coming back to the president's proposal from Capitol Hill Republicans and Democrats on this, on the big planks of what he's pushing here? Assault weapons ban, a limit on the size of ammunition magazines, the clip, universal background checks. What do you see coming back at him?
Well, what we hear most, and especially from Democrats, who I think are really key in this, because you're not going to find support for the president's ideas among many Republicans. So if you look at Democrats who also feel very strongly about Second Amendment protections for all the political reasons that Jake talked about, and also their own life experience, depending on where they are from in the country, because of the deep regional and life experience differences that bring people to this issue. What I'm told is that the idea of universal background checks is maybe the first step that there could be some level of consensus. One of the things Democrats will have to do over the next few days after the inauguration and some of the events of the next week, meet together, look at the president's proposals and decide how do they want to proceed on the Senate side. We won't see any action on the House side. So for Harry Reid, who has been a strong proponent of gun rights, has been heavily supported by the NRA, by sportsmen, he is in a difficult position because he is saying if it cannot pass on the House, then why would the Senate try to take votes that would be politically very difficult for some of their members, especially those up for re-election in 2014? So an assault weapons ban, the background checks, looking at the high-capacity ammunition clips, would they look at all of those as one piece of legislation or break it down? And what I'm hearing more and more is the idea of taking pieces of it. If you add the assault weapons ban, ask people to vote for that, the likelihood of the whole package failing is much greater. So if they want to try to accomplish something that people can agree about, perhaps the background checks is a way to do it. One of the things you hear all the time, though, is the issue of they can pass a law, but will it be effective? And one of the questions you have, which comes back to what Republicans are saying, looking at mental health issues. Well, Democrats would get behind that as well. but there are real concerns about taking some action that might be questionable in the minds of people who have very strong feelings about the Second Amendment. But would it even be effective? And that is a question that there are not easy answers to, and it's something that I see lawmakers really grappling with.
Jack, how do you see it on the Democratic side? Let's look. We kind of know the Republican side here, but on the Democratic side, step up alongside the president or duck and cover from his full range of proposals?
Well, I think we have the intimations here that Harry Reid wants this cup to pass from him, that he really wants to be able to say that, look, the House won't act. I can't make my five or six senators who are up in 2014 in red states. I can't make them walk the plank. But this is where the president comes in. And above all, this is where we come in. You know, the president really made it very clear. He said, it's up to us. If we don't force the politicians to act on guns, they'll do what they are have long felt most comfortable doing on guns, nothing. You know, and his urgency, which I think was admirable, and his, the note of it really mirrored President Kennedy's fine speech of 1963 after the Birmingham bombings. In words that really apply to now and to guns and to us, the president said, we are confronted with a moral crisis as a country and a people. Now is the time for Congress to act. The president, Obama, said, Congress must act and act soon. And he went on, this is our first task as a society, keeping kids safe. This is how we will be judged. You know, we all know that. Mm. If the gun lobby wins, we will have failed.
Well, really, fair enough, Jack, but don't you have to sit back? You know, there's a little bit of who's we, Kimo Sabe. I mean, there's this new NBC poll out that says, yes, 56% of Americans support more gun control, but, you know, high 40s, mid-40s, not so crazy about it, and the support for it much less today than it was in the 1990s. I mean, there's no uniform we here, Jack.
No, but the president, I think, was calling on even the we of people who support gun rights to say, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Is this an axial moment, this massacre? Are we just going to try to do prudent things here, like background checks that could really make a difference? And I think his we there is the moral community. You know, if you think you can save a life, even one child's life or one person's life, by passing a piece of legislation which otherwise will not harm anybody's rights, aren't you obliged to do that?
Let's go to Jim in Newtown, Connecticut, calling us today. Jake, Kelly, Jack, stand by. Jim in Newtown, thank you for your call from that platform. What do you see here, Jim?
Thank you, Tom. I hope that the president will allude to Sandy Hook Promise in his inauguration speech. Sandy Hook Promise is a group that's come together here in Newtown around the parents that have lost their children and their close neighbors. And they had a major news conference just the other day. And at sandyhookpromise.org, listeners can make the promise, they can sign the promise. And it's so simple. It's the group is just saying, to truly honor the lives lost, let's turn this tragedy into a moment of transformation. And it's a promise to be open to all possibilities. There's no agenda other than to make our community and our nation safer and to have the conversations on all the issues where listening is as important as speaking, and conversations where even those with the most opposing views can debate in goodwill. That's sandyhookpromise.org. And please come and look at this site, okay?
And please, Mr. President, mention it in your inauguration speech. Jim, are you in the school system? Did you know families? Did you know students there from the terrible killing?
Very, very well. I have had a student, I'm a music teacher privately, and lost one of my students, and everyone's been so great, the outpouring.
But do you feel like the country...
We can't thank you guys enough.
We hear that, and we appreciate it.
It means so much. Thank you.
But do you feel that the country, the administration, the Congress, is turning toward a sufficient response to the horror you saw in your town, Jim?
I believe they must, and they will, and I applaud the state of New York for what has happened there. There is no reason that I can see that it should be legal to have an assault weapon that in 2 seconds can destroy so many lives. That is a weapon of mass destruction. Would you agree, Tom?
Listen, I don't want an assault weapon anywhere near any school that my kids are in, so I guess I don't want it near any school that any kids are in. But there's the dilemma we're up against. There are a lot of them in this country. Jim, our sympathies to Newtown and our thanks to you for calling. Thank you very much. Let me get one more right here. Georgetown, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi,
Dan. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people reacting to the government's behavior over the last 10 years. We've taken a very bad turn in our country, and we've relied on non-factual things to guide us and to go through major changes, and changes have resulted in the losing of an awful lot of rights of American people and people around the world, for that matter. We've taken habeas corpus, which is the fair treatment of human beings, and we've thrown that out the window. And apparently, that's okay. Because
you mean Guantanamo or something? But are you saying that's why Americans are arming up more in this country? And it certainly appears they are. Is that what you're saying, Dan?
I'm saying that a reason people are arming up is exactly why the Constitution, the Second Amendment outlines why citizens should be armed.
Dan, let us pick it up. Jake Tapper, you've covered Washington a lot. You've seen all the policies out there. You know what Dan's saying, certainly abroad in the land. Does it sound reasonable to you, or does it sound out there? I mean, here's a listener online says, I use a flintlock Kentucky long rifle to hunt deer. You know, there's the other side of this, not arming up for insurrection or to protect oneself against Big Brother, but hey, a flintlock long rifle to hunt some deer, and nobody would have much of a problem. Reasonable fear or, I don't know, nutty, Jake?
I'll tell you, you mentioned earlier when you were introducing me that I wrote this book, The Outpost, about Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and the only reason I bring that up is because I am now friends with lots of people who are active duty military, and I see their Facebook pages and their pages and their posts. And a lot of them are very enthusiastic owners of firearms, and a lot of them feel that there is this encroaching that is about to happen on their rights. And their perspective is they have been trained, they are responsible gun owners. And they do not understand why those people who cannot use these devices safe. Well, it's not even that. It's why anybody would blame an insane person with this weapon would blame the weapon as opposed to the insane person. That's their perspective, and I hear it a lot. And it's not those aren't voices you hear a lot in newsrooms in Washington, D.C. Or New York City.
Maybe it depends.
There might be a couple places, but generally speaking, it's not a perspective. And I think.
But do we have to live in this world that's just soaked in guns? I mean,
there are about, what are the 300 million firearms in this country?
Is that really
million?
The country we have to be? Is that just it? We're doomed to that?
But I guess my question is, what's the proposal? Snap your fingers and they disappear?
No, but we do have some proposals on the table right now. Jake, we got to take a break here. Jake Tapper, CNN, please stand by. Kelly O'Donnell at NBC News. Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Boeing's 787 Dreamliner was grounded by the FAA, in trouble all over. Here's one passenger in Chicago stranded off a flight to Poland.
They canceled the flight because they had a few fires on the planes, and we were wondering about that. We got some message like in the afternoon that there was another fire.
A few fires on the planes, and they're grounded very widely. Great strangeness around Notre Dame linebacker Manti Te'o and an apparently fictional girlfriend who fictionally died. Here was Te'o in October.
When you have somebody that you talk to every single day, that you sleep with on the phone because she's going through a lot of things, and the only way that she can sleep is if she knows that you're on the other side of the phone, and all of a sudden it's silence. That silence really eats at you.
That was October. Here was Deadspin.com reporter Timothy Burke this week on the Today Show. The story didn't add up. Big media bought it. It was some kind of hoax.
something wasn't right here. And we have five separate dates that she allegedly died in major media sources.
And hosts Tina Fey and Amy Poehler wowed at the Golden Globes Sunday.
The Hunger Games was one of the biggest films of the year, and also what I call the 6 weeks it took me to get into this dress.
Ang Lee's been nominated for Best Director for The Life of Pi, which is what I'm going to call the 6 weeks after I take this dress off.
We're looking at a week in the news. Guns, hostages, Lance Armstrong, and more. Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News is with us, covers Capitol Hill. Jake Tapper is here, chief Washington correspondent and anchor for CNN. Jack Beatty's here. Inauguration's coming up. Here's a little preparation going on this week. Marching band, military rehearsing in front of the Capitol building. This was on Monday while construction went on in the background.
Barack H. Obama.
We'll hear a lot more of that on Monday. You can join us this hour. What do you want to hear from the president on Monday, on Inauguration Day? What's the opening message you want on his second term? Let's go to Waterloo, Iowa. Jordan. Hi, Jordan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are we doing?
Okay. What do you think?
Well, I think that a huge focus of President Obama's speech is going to be on the massacre, Sandy Hook, and gun reform, but we have many more issues to cover, and I'd like him to cover that in our inaugural speech. The Syria issue, foreign policy, our economic issues, and my big fear is that it's just going to be a diatribe for gun control.
So you're a little worried about a one-trick, one-note speech on Monday. Let us pick it up, Kelly, and I appreciate your call. Kelly O'Donnell, what are you expecting Monday? What do you think people
I
want to hear? What do you think is coming?
I don't expect that because the president has spoken with some heart, a degree of emotion we don't always see from him. He's spoken a great deal about guns. A speech like an inaugural address lives for a much longer time and has to be much broader in its view of where the president wants to take the country. So while I think he will acknowledge the country's pain over the Newtown issue and the difficult kind of choices that are in front of us as to what to do about that, both on the weapons side as well as the underlying causes, I don't think the president will spend a great deal of time on that in his inaugural address. That's just my assessment, not based on anything they're telling us. What they're telling us at the moment is that he's writing it longhand on yellow legal pads, and they're not going to preview much of it because it should be its own event on Monday. What I am struck by in just coming to work at the Capitol day after day is you begin to see the pieces of the inaugural celebration coming together. And much like life in America, there is the grandness of it. And then I walk by several hundred brand new porta potties that have been put there and ready for the big crowds for Monday. So there are these contrasts that become a part of what an inauguration is. There is the spectacle of it. There is the sense of history. And then there's the more nitty gritty day in the life we have right now and some of the hard issues. And for this second inaugural address, I think it's a much greater challenge for the president because he has had the burden of governing, and this is his last opportunity to speak in a setting like this. It might be one of the most important moments of the second term in terms of the country sort of taking its breath, looking to him and saying, what direction do you see the country going?
We are occasionally soaring creatures. We are very earthly creatures. There's a president with his yellow pad writing longhand. Jake, channel a little bit for us. You've covered him closely. Here's, as Kelly says, a big moment. This is one, again, for the history books, maybe. What are you expecting or imagining, maybe, on President Obama's second term tongue on Monday?
Well, I think that his tone on Monday will not necessarily match the tone of his second administration. I think that his second administration seems to have gotten off to a more aggressive approach, I guess I should say, with the picks of Hagel and Kerry, with some of the comments he's made dealing with the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling, especially. I think that he's I don't want to say a partisan tone, but he certainly, his patience with Congress has worn thin. I don't think you're necessarily going to hear that, of course, in his inaugural address. I think you'll hear more about the need for the country to come together to find solutions to the great problems we have, including the budget mess, including gun violence, including the role of the United States in the world. That's more traditionally what an inaugural address would be about in terms of uniting themes. But I do think that what's more significant than what he says on Monday is how he governs on Tuesday, and I think that is going to be more aggressive and more assertive, perhaps even though you could look back on his first term and say healthcare, Wall Street reform, the stimulus, a lot these were not necessarily the most bipartisan and passive bills in the world. But I think in terms of his second term, I think he has more confidence and less patience.
Jack, we've certainly seen hints of a more feisty kind of governance, executive leadership from the White House since Election Day. And yet there's a kind of opportunity for the president to talk about fundamental positioning in the universe on Inauguration Day. What are you expecting Monday, Jack?
Well, I expect a combination of those things, actually, because he's in the position now on the spread of issues where he can talk the American majority on guns now, since Newtown. Polls are clear on that. He can talk the American majority on immigration reform, sweeping immigration reform. He can talk that way on entitlement spending, which people want contained but really not cut. He can talk that way on taxes. People want a fair on the debt resolution. They want a fair. In other words, he can talk the majority, whom he carried in the election, and each of those are wedge issues on the Republican Party. He's found a way, I think, just because of the way things have turned out, the way the election, to continually hammer at the GOP coalition. And we've seen, you know, that beginning to fracture on the three votes we've had, the two on Sandy and the one on the fiscal cliff. You saw a break in the Republican coalition. That could continue. That could be the nucleus of a new sort of bipartisan, Obama majority. But in any case, I think he's going to sound lofty with these national themes. But down below, these are wedge issues.
Go back to 04 for a minute. The Democratic convention, the speech he gave that made him a national figure. We're not red states. We're not blue states. We're the United States. Is that gone at inauguration 2013, Jack?
I think he would like to bring it back. And I think these, by touching on, you know, don't we all agree on, he will try to hit some of that that note. While at the same time advancing an agenda that, yes, it looks majoritarian, it's also aimed right at the Republic.
Dana is calling from South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, thank you for taking the call. Yes, I would like to hear President Obama Monday address what I feel are two fundamental issues, climate change and poverty. We're the richest country in the world, and the poverty is so obscene that I'm doing my best to refrain from using profanity.
Thank you.
But anyway, those are really serious fundamental issues, and I feel the reason they're not addressed is because there's a lot of vested, well-heeled interests who are forbidding it or are limiting discussion of it. I notice it's very scantily covered in the news.
Well, I mean, the economy certainly gets covered. Poverty has had more attention lately, but it's bigger than the attention it gets. I don't know, Kelly. You can pick your docket items here, but those are big ones. Climate change, poverty, Dana wants to hear on Monday. Do you expect to hear those references?
I would think there would be perhaps a glancing reference because those are core issues. I don't see them as being a central part of the president's message other than in a broader sense of how, as a nation that is this wealthy, we have a responsibility to take care of those who are most vulnerable. And that message strikes a lot of things, not only poverty, but other kinds of vulnerabilities in American life. Climate has been an issue that is certainly not getting the attention that people might have expected with this president. Will it in a second term? So often the areas where a president focuses are really controlled by outside events that grab the collective attention and demand attention, such as what we've talked about with respect to guns, where it was not really much of an issue politically for this president in the first term. And in this moment, it has become an issue where he wants to use the force of his presidency. Interestingly, I work for NBC News, and I know that they are beginning a real campaign to focus on issues related to poverty. I've got some colleagues who are going to be devoting their time to that. So for your caller, I would encourage you to look for that, especially for NBCNews.com, for a focus there. It is an aching need in this country, and it does not get the attention that it deserves. And many people talk about some of the economic issues, and if some of the bigger economic issues can be moved forward in a positive way, that may alleviate some of the burden and may have some positive effect. But the financial crises that face the country broadly are so great that the most vulnerable are often not given the attention they deserve. I mean,
outside events, yes, they may drive things, but step outside on climate change. And we've seen plenty of severity right there. Sarah in New York City, thanks for calling. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm all for gun control and saving lives. And I would like the conversation at the inauguration and throughout Obama's next term to be also about pro-choice, saving women's lives, affordable health care, continuing so that women are have accessible health care, so that abortions can be safe and available. I still feel like my reproductive rights and all the women of the United States and the world are still under assault, and I would love for that to be an issue again.
Sarah, thanks for your call from New York. Jake, I mean, people have their issues that they want right up there, poverty, climate change, women's health and rights there from Sarah in New York. What do you see as actually being at the top of the president's action agenda beyond the speech Monday, Jake?
Two things, immigration reform and tax reform, and probably in that order. There already is, as Kelly knows better than I, there already are several working groups on Capitol Hill, bipartisan groups of senators talking about ways to bring forward some sort of comprehensive immigration reform. Again, the problem is always going to be the House, where there is a lot of reluctance to have immigration reform pass. A lot of the, as the parties go on their geographical directions, it's been more difficult to get immigration reform measures as the Republican Party in the House especially becomes more and more of a Southern party. And as Democrats start to win a lot of these border areas, border states, it makes it more difficult to pass immigration reform. And then tax reform, obviously, there is an appetite for it writ large. I don't know, you know, obviously, to use the cliche, the devil's in the details, and I think it'd be difficult to get anything accomplished. But that's where historically in the last few months the White House and some GOP leaders have talked about there being possible areas for compromise.
Kelly, it seems like immigration may come right up. What do you see coming there? Is the GOP changing on the basis of election results in November? Can you see something that would put the whatever the number is, 11 million, on a path to citizenship? Will the president champion that?
Well, clearly it matters to the president, and we are beginning to see, especially among some, I think, nationally prominent Republican senators, Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, who had been given an opportunity in the past to try to be for immigration, then sort of in 2010 with his own reelection, became more focused on the border fence, now talking again about some way to resolve this issue. I think it's the exigencies politically, but also the reality that this is an ongoing problem. And one of the things Democrats have tried to do is to focus on that group of young people who were brought here as young children who are not born in this country but have made this country kind of the only place they've ever known. They're called the Dreamers because of the acronym used with the potential law that would give them some opportunities. That is a place where they have started. I think if you look to Marco Rubio and some of what he is trying to put together, there is kind of a sense that there may be a moment to look at this. He's got a lot politically on his shoulders if he is going to be a national candidate in the future, but he also brings some credibility as the son of Cuban immigrants and as a voice in a state where this issue is so critical in Florida. When you look at what's happening, it does seem like there will be action on immigration. How far it goes will be determined, but I think Republicans are recognizing that simply focusing on securing the border, as important as that is, has not been sufficient to address this issue. I think they realize that there has to be something done, but there's still great concern about unintended consequences. If they take action, will there be something that they cannot foresee that would further weaken the country's ability to make its own decisions about who should be here legally, who should not? But there does seem to be a political moment coming for immigration.
Jack, a message of collaboration on Monday, or here we go to the trenches?
I think it'll certainly be collaboration. I mean, that is the president's instinct. That's where he found his political voice. That's really that's what got him into office the first time. On the other hand, he was just elected, and let's just say that was quite an achievement. I think it's his second only president since Eisenhower to go above 50 twice. So that's really
and only
quite
16 since the founding of the republic.
There you go. And you know, he was elected by a new coalition, and he's got to speak to them. And they want things done for them. And right at the top is immigration reform. So I think he will push that.
Eyes open as we go into President Barack Obama's second inauguration day. Our gratitude to each of you for being with us today. Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. Wonderful to have you, Kelly. Thanks so much
for
joining us. Jake Tapper, now anchorman and chief Washington correspondent at CNN. Jake, thanks so much for joining us today.
As always, Tom, a pleasure.
Jack, we'll be watching on Monday. Thanks for your heads up today, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Great conversations, On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.